Succession number 20601, Reel 3.
Robin Newell, Reel 3.
Well, we marched to Lowham Street Station, and we'd been singing all the filthy songs all the way along the road, and when we got there, the train was waiting for us, and Major Woolley, who was temporarily in command, I don't know where Lieutenant Colonel Rees was, but Major Woolley was temporary second in command, and he stood on a luggage truck and he said, "I leave 4-5 Commander with a nasty taste in my mouth. I've never heard anything so disgusting and filthy in all my life." Anyhow, we got on the train and we went down to Eastbourne. At Eastbourne we had nice civvy billets. We did further training, but this time on LCIs, S, which is a landing craft infantry small, which are made of about 1-inch plywood, and got a fair old about 30-knot speed, driven by 2,000 gallons of high-octane fuel on the back end, which is very handy if you're getting shelled. Anyhow, we did quite a bit of training on those and several exercises round about. One was against the headquarters of the, I think it was the Guards Armoured Div, down towards Shoreham, I think. Anyhow, we went there. We went down in the truck and we bowed out while it was doing 30 mile an hour. Look, presumably, as you would do it, a thing like that. And we went in there and we went round the thing. They got no idea we were there, although they were on this exercise just the same as us. There was a military policeman guarding a bit round the corner, and our officer who was then Captain Rushforth, he gave us the signals and he went up and he tried to get him in a Japanese death lock, and unfortunately he pushed his thumb in his mouth. And we could hear a lot of grunting and hollering about, and Jock had got his pistol out, he was belting him across the head with it. He said, "He's got my bloody thumb in his mouth." Well, Jock's thumb is all right as far as I know to this day, but that guardsman, that military policeman, he thought it was the end of the world. He didn't know who we were or what we were. Well, we went in the place, we got in trouble afterwards because they went into the control room where all the switchboard was, and they pulled all the jacks out and cut the leads and God knows what. I think that was out of commission for several days. But although we had a blast for doing it, we were commended on the fact that we'd done a successful business there. Anyway,
What is the Japanese death lock?
Well, it's oh dear, it's one arm round the neck. You must look at me. It's one arm round the neck, right arm round the neck, the left arm up over the back of the head, and this, your right wrist is then under the throat, and if you put the pressure on, that separates your spinal cord, and that's you finished. And he got him in a light death lock or toy to, and he got his thumb in his mouth. Anyhow, Jock Rushforth, who's Major Rushforth, he is still alive, he's in Canada, he's been over to one or two reunions, and he's still a fine gentleman. I always liked the man and always got on very, very well with him. And I think all the people were the same. He was very fair. If you committed a crime, he used to smile when he was giving you your punishment. And that always took the pain out of it. Anyhow, we continued on these ships, and we used to go down to where? I can't think where the dock was now. We used to go down to one of the docks with a mole there, and we used to go aboard and go out into the channel and sport rain, go along the beaches, do various landings there. And on one of these episodes, we're down in the mess deck below, and they're very, very cramped. And I sat there and I was looking round at the construction of the thing. And there's a lattice beam goes across under the deck, you know, for strength. And I looked at it, and it snapped a two, and the two ends were going backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards. Well, I went and found Jock Rushforth, and they come down and looked at it with the ship's officer, and we very soon made it back to port. How long it would have lasted, I don't know. Anyhow, that was that. Well, we did a lot of landings round Littlehampton area. A place called Climpin was another one just there. And one of the culminating points of these exercises, because boy, then it's getting on towards D-Day. One of the culminating points, we used to land, go inshore, and boy, then we got cycles, little folding parabikes, and we were the troop who we would use these things so we could get a bait much quicker, and we used to have hooks on the front which would take our Bergen rucksacks, which we now got in place of the ordinary web packs, and you could get a devil of a lot of stuff in them, and my God, they put a devil of a lot of stuff in them, because you all had a load, you know, you carried bombs for the mortars and all sorts of things, and extra machine gun stuff, and, you know, magazines and ammunition for this, that and the other. Anyhow, what we did, we had these cycles, and we only did that exercise once, but we used to go through the proceedings, and they found a bit of the river below Arundel, which turned a big S bend, and we didn't know it at the time, but we crossed, we had rubber dinghies, which we also carried, and we got it off to a fine art. We went in front of the rest of them, pumped the dinghies up, rowed them across the river, had a rope on both ends of the dinghy, and a team used to run like the devil and pull it backwards and forward, which is four times as fast as you could row it over. And then we used to go on a little bit, come back to the river and do that yet again, which in fact was really practicing for crossing the Orne Canal and the River Orne, which we never had to use, thank God. Anyhow, we did that, and I always remember we passed the heavy troop through there, and one of the chaps, and who he is I don't know and we'll never know, he dumped his 3-inch mortar barrel in the bottom of the boat, and that went straight through the bottom. We never did see it again, because it was all very heavy mud up the sides there, being a tidal river. Anyway, we did all that, and on one of those, we were going back through a rundle along the road in Achachfyle, and a Humber snipe pulled up the opposite side of the road, and it was Brigadier Lord Lover, who I'd seen before, but never knew. And he looked at me, I was the corporal in the lead, he said, "Who are you?" And I told him, he said, "It can't be, you shouldn't be here yet, you've done it very well," and he, "well done, lads," and with that he was gone. Lord Lovett, as far as I was concerned, seemed to be a complete gentleman. Very, very well decorated man, as we all know. Anyhow, we messed about there for quite a bit, and finally, in towards the end of May, I don't know the date now, we left to go for Normandy. Incidentally, in between wars, we've been transported to the back of Southampton, and we into a huge park there. Must have been a big haste there somewhere. And we lined first SS Brigade, which we now belong to, which was 4-5 Commando, 3-4 and 6 Army Commandos. We now formed the first SS Brigade, and we lined the track where the King was supposed to be driving in. And it was a long, winding track, and we stood both sides of the road. And we got there quite early in the morning, and a truck would be seen coming up this road about a mile away. We'd all fall in. Eight would come, the blokes from the spinnies, with a duster to dust your boots off. And when it come by, that'd be a sergeant going along with a ration for somebody or other. And we had about four or five sort of false businesses, and then finally they arrived, and it was King George the Fifth, and he walked
George
along.
The Sixth.
Pardon?
The Sixth, I think. King George the Sixth.
Sorry, King George the Sixth. Yeah, you're quite right. It was King George the Sixth, and he was all in his khaki red, all his gear, you know, and when he went up one side and down the other, and I always remember when he got near us. He was questioning whoever was with him, and I don't know who it was. And he said, well, what happened to the old Marine Division? Well, actually, he was looking at it. But he obviously didn't know they'd been sort of disbanded and formed into commandos. A lot of our people went into landing craft. You know, those who were probably getting a bit older and weren't all that fit and didn't want to be in the commando, they went to landing craft and you name it. Anyway, we left Eastbourne. Well, we had a bit of a party the night before. Myself and Ronnie Stewart, we took our subsections up to the tally-ho, and I remember my first round of drinks was 31 whiskies. And the old boy fetched us the bottle, someone don't know where he got it from. Anyway, we had quite a nice night there, a drop of beer and one thing and another. And Jimmy Montgomery, who was one of our men, came from, I think, Nitzhill in Glasgow. He was a big fella, about 6'1" or 6'2". And when he got excited, you could never understand him. Now, he never drunk beer in his life. And when we came to go at night, you know, when the pub threw us out, somebody says, "Well, where's Jimmy got to?" Well, we looked and we couldn't find him. We looked all over, we couldn't find him. We found him in the loo, flat out on the floor with his trousers around his ankles. He'd been sick and bad and God knows what. Anyway, we got him together and whoever was in the billet with him, they took him home. And we had to fall in at, I think it was 4 a.m. at Eastbourne Station. Well, we got down there and we fell in. Well, one or two of the blokes were a little bit woozy. I had no sleep and one thing or another. But Jimmy Montgomery, they brought him down. He was almost unconscious and he was bent double. And we fell in for the officer's inspection. Major Rush was he was then. And he got down to Jimmy Montgomery, who was almost next door to me, and he said, "You two men, hold him to attention while I inspect him." And he had a look at me and said, "Righto, that was it." Well, Jimmy Montgomery, he knew nothing about all that. He was just unconscious, you know. Anyway, we then got aboard our train and we went so far, and we went into a we call it a concentration camp, for want of a better word. He went into this camp which was run by the Americans, where all the briefing took part for D-Day. No one was laid in, no one was laid out, only by special pass. We did quite a few speed marches while we were there, but we were surrounded by military police on bikes to keep up with us, you know, because we were running. And we used to meet various other commandos, three, four and six along the road, and there was always the great cheer went up as you passed each other. And then we came back, and from there on, we must have been there about a fortnight, I suppose. We had American food while we were there, and American rations, which were very, very generous and very, very good as opposed to our food. Our food was poor compared with theirs. They had everything. I mean, when you went to draw your ration, if you went anywhere, and especially when we were off to Normandy, we drew our 24-hour emergency rations, and there they were. They got handfuls of fags for everyone. Now, I never smoked, and all my cigarettes went to, you know, some of the boys in my section, and there were boiled sweets. There was everything you could think of there. Anyhow, we left there. For Warsash, which was where we left on the Solent, and we left to go there on the night of the 4th, but of course the invasion was called off, so we slept in the field that night. And anyhow, the following day they said, "Well, we think it's on," which would be then the 5th. Well, on the night of the 5th, or the evening of the 5th, we went aboard our LSI, which was 5-8, and we went aboard and got settled down and got our gear. We had all the cycles stacked one end of the ship, and I mean, when you've got all your gear, there's no room for anything on them. And we sat there for a while, and then we moved out into the Solent, and it was led by Lord Lovett with his piper, who's Bill Millin, and he played us up the Solent. And there were transports and ships of there seemed to be thousands of them, and they all lined the sides and cheered us as we went through them. And then we sort of went out a fair bit, and we sort of idled our time, and then we finally set sail for Normandy. We didn't really know, well, we knew where it was, but we knew where it was. We'd seen all the maps and all the all the briefing, you know, but we didn't really know where on the coast it was. One of our chaps, a bloke named Mackenzie, Mac Mackenzie, he was Lieutenant Jackson's batman actually. When we were being briefed, he said to George Jackson, he said, "Oh, I know that place. Oh, we've been there." He said he was a chap who used to go on holiday on a bike, and he'd ridden all over England. He'd been all over the place, and he knew where the bridges were, and he knew where the river was and the canal, and he knew it. And Jackson said, "Well, you all you know it, but keep it to yourself. Don't say a word." But anyhow, that was that. I mean, that came out afterwards. Anyhow, we landed, I think, at 9:10 on the morning of June the 6th. When we ran into the beach up there, 518 was next door to us, which was B Troop, I think. That received several hits. Prior to that, I looked across and there was a Corporal Cohen, who was a peacetime Marine, and I knew him very, very well. He was a hell of a boy. Always in trouble, but he was a fine soldier, hard as nails. And we looked across boat to boat, and we could only been sort of 15 or 20 feet apart, and we extended the thumbs to each other like that. And there was a hell of a bang and spike, and about three or four matlows and three or four more Marines were gone. And the ramps were, oh dear. Anyhow, by then we're too involved. Our ramps got crossed. We had one ramp that was okay, and the other one was crossed across and impossible to get on it, which the sailors used to push them down. Like a crew, we used to slide them over the bay, but it was heaving about so much, I suppose they lost control of them. Anyway, we all had to come down the one ramp, and that wasn't bad with all your gear and a cycle as well. Anyway, we got on there, and when we got off the beach, onto the beach, we didn't hang a bait, we just went straight through the... Who was it? Was it the East Yorks or the Suffolks, I think, were on our beach, supposed to take the beach area. Well, they were still laid on the beach doing nothing. Anyway, we went straight through them and left them to it. And we had a point about 1,000 yards inland, which was like a spinney where all the brigade would assemble. Well, we went across this. It was all been flooded. It was all full of dikes. And if you ever go to war with anything, don't take a pushboat, because the weed and the rubbish out of these ditches, that hung every bit. They had wing nuts on the wheels and straight metal pegs for the pedals. And this weed was hanging on to everything. And I mean, that must have weighed four times what they ought to do. Anyway, we finally got to our meeting up point. And it was there that I saw Lieutenant Wardle, who'd been our instructor at Acna Carry. And he'd been lightly wounded. He was covered in blood all over his face. And he recognised me, and we said a few words, and with that we were gone. Anyway, we then sort of proceeded. We went out in front on our bikes and got to various points. We never saw a lot of Germans, one or two pillboxes and one or two strong points, which we dealt with. And finally we got to Pegasus Bridge. And as we went across Pegasus Bridge, the airborne were there, and they were very, very glad to see us, I think. There's no doubt about that. And we went across the bridge, and of course, then across the river. But unfortunately, on the bridge, Lieutenant Colonel Rees, who was our CO, was badly wounded through the thighs. And he laid in the middle of the road, and we just rode straight by him and couldn't do nothing for him or help him. There was quite a bit of sniper fire on the bridge and across. Anyway, we rode round, got the other side of over the canal and then over the river, got the other side of that, and we were going for Salinelles. That was our first place to go. And when we got round the corner, we ditched all our rubber dinghies and all the ropes for pulling, which made a lot of difference to us because they were very, very heavy. We ditched all that lot and left it there. From there on we went down towards Salinelles, and we stopped outside, and Jock Rusher said to me, "Take your section and go down that road to the coast." Well, I went down to the coast, which is almost opposite Oostrium, and we went down there. We went down on our boats. We went in several houses, which were sort of sunshine houses, I suppose holiday homes normally. We went down there. We never saw a soul, not French or German. we went down there, and when we came back, there was nothing there. We just thought, well, I don't know, this is queer. Well, we then grouped again, and we went up to near to the gun battery at Merville, and we got up there, and we sort of looked at the place through the heavy defences it had got there. It had been bombed by the RAF so much it was almost impenetrable to get near it. There were so many holes, it was terrible. Anyway, we got there, and we sort of were looking at it across 100 or 200 yards away from it, and we had a message we had to leave it. So we left that, and we went down and got into a farmhouse at Merville itself. Well, we got in there and we did manage to cook a little bit of grub. And from there we went back down to, I think we probably slept the night there. Then the next night we went back the other side of Salinels and dug in on a hillside there. Our mortars opened up on a target somewhere or other, which were behind us, and they very soon returned the fire straight back where it came from. And so we had to get it there a bit quick. It was obvious that the Germans had got OP posts everywhere, and they knew exactly where it was. There were range cards about which had everything to the yard. So it was no wonder they knew exactly where we were and what we were doing. Anyhow, we dug into this place, and boy, then the jeeps arrived with our extra ammunition and things, and the Vickers K gun for one. And anyhow, we sort of prepared for it. Well, then the next thing was move out again. So we moved out again, went down to Frankville Plage, which we were supposed to clear. Well, we got into Frankville Plage, and we were eight on to the left flank, and we had a recall. The rest of them got the various targets down the main road and the side roads into Frankville, and they'd struck a very heavy party of Germans there. I mean, I don't know how many, probably several companies, which are about 100-odd apiece. Anyhow, we had to go back, and we actually saved the commando from getting isolated there, because we came back and broke the German forces and got them out. From there, we went back up to Merville again. Now, in Merville, it's quite a nice old farmhouse there. And we got in that, and the Germans, we could see them several hundred yards away, and we sort of exchanged fire with them on and off. Freddie Bartholomew was up in the roof along with one or two more, and he being a sniper, he got his telescope out to see if he could see where they were and who they were and what he was going to do about it. Well, he said to me afterwards, he said, that was my fault, Nob. He said, I never pulled the shade on the front of the telescope, which shaded the lens. He said, I'm looking through the roof where a tile was missing. He said, within a few seconds, a bullet came in and took the thing out of my hands. And that was the finish of that. He still has the telescope to this day. There's not a lot wrong with it, but you couldn't use it very well. Anyhow, we defended that place. I don't know how many attacks they made on us, several. I myself was in an eight house, and they were coming across the orchard at us, and really, without a boast or anything like that, it was like shooting fish in a barrel, because they came across so many of them, and we just shot them one after the other, and then they would withdraw, and then again and again and again. Anyhow, at this juncture, we left it again, and we went down into Frankville again, and I was a bit isolated. I went across the way a little bit, and Jock Rushford, our major, the CO, he came along, and he came with me, and he said, "Neil, we'll go through that gate and see what's the other side." Well, it turned out it was the school, part of the school buildings. Well, he opened the gate and stepped through, and a hail of machine gun fire met him. He was badly wounded through the waist somewhere. And he threw his rifle. He says, "The bastards have got me." He threw his rifle over the wall, and followed it over. And when I got hold of him, and I carted him back to where people could help him, and then returned where I'd come from. And I didn't go through that wall again. I knew what was there. I kept well away from that. But anyhow, we hung on and hung on, and then we finally withdrew back to Merville again that night. Well, they got the wounded in a farm car, and the roads are gravel and the wheels were steel rims, and I think you could have heard that 5 mile away. And they got Jock Rush for stood in it, because I don't think he could sit very well. And I looked up at him and I says, "You're all right, Jock?" And he remembers that. He remembers it to this day. And the archery game, he was not very gentlemanly. Anyhow, that was the finish of Jock Rushforth there, anyhow. Well, we went on and we went back up to Merville again eventually, because we had to abandon the Frankville Plage job. We went back up to Merville again. And to this day, I don't know who asked me, but someone says, "Newell, go up that little track and see what you can see." Well, I went up there, and when I came back about half hour later, there wasn't a soul there. They'd all withdrawn and gone. Anyhow, I thought, well, I don't know what to do about this. So anyhow, I knew which way we'd come, and I knew as far as I did that Salinelles was still in our hands. Anyway, we went down this sort of farm track, which was long and twisty and amongst the trees. We went down this track, and I did anyhow. And on the way down, I picked up another straggler, a bloke named Green, who was also in our troop. And we went down, and we got to an open bit, and we ran across it, and there was a burst of fire. He was wounded in his left leg. And here there was a ditch the other side of the track. We got in this ditch, which was full of green, slimy water. Well, I could stay on the bank, because I got both legs, but he just rolled in it, and oh, he stunk to heaven. Well, anyhow, he got a field dressing on his leg, and it was a damn great hole through his calf. And from then on, I had the two rifles. We waited a bit, and then edged on, and got where there was a little bit more cover. And I got him down towards Salinelles, and on the outskirts, there was a farmhouse, or it looked like a farmhouse to me. We went in there, and he was absolutely done and whacked. And I said, "Well, hold on." I said, "We're not going any farther in daylight. We'll wait till dark, and then we'll find them." Well, I found an old mattress, and he laid on a mattress, and we had a drop of wine, which I found, and one and the other, and he went to sleep. And I was just thinking of moving on, and of course the floors were covered with glass. There wasn't a window left in the place, and I heard a lot of marching of feet, and I thought, "Hello, that's our chaps going out or coming back in again." And I thought, "Well, I don't know that. I'll hang on a bit." Well, I hung on a bit, and I heard somebody come up to the front door, and I heard it crash open. And the door opened. I was behind the door. The door opened, and I saw the muzzle of a Schmeisser come in, and a lot of grunting, and I knew darn well it wasn't one of ours. Anyhow, the chap went out, and he went upstairs, and I looked at him, and I thought to myself, "Well, can I get my rifle?" Which was the other side, sort of behind the door really. And then I thought, "Well, I'll never get there with all this broken glass on the floor." And I was just going to make my mind up what to do, and he came down the stairs, and he pushed the door again, and of course it's pushed up against me, and I reckon I could read his mind almost. He said, "Well, what's behind this door?" Well, he pulled the door open, and he rammed the muzzle of his Schmeisser in my stomach with the words, "Hand the hock, Schweinhund." Anyhow, that, as far as I was concerned, that was the finish of me. He called out, and some more fellas come in. They found an old bike, and they put the fella on Green on this bike, and I pushed the bike. One of them got hold of my rifle and smashed it against the wall and broke the butt off, and he did the same with Green's rifle. We then we went back through Salinelles a little way, and there was a haste lays back on the seaward side of Salinelles, and that was evidently a German headquarters, had been for a long while. And they took us there, and they searched us again and again and again, and made us sit against the wall. We were very soon joined by two fellas from 6th Commando. One was Gunnar Rolf, and I can't think of the other fella's name. And Gunnar Rolf had been in North Africa, and he said, "I've been involved with the Germans. We never thought we'd ever get taken prisoner." To which I replied, "Well, neither did I." I said, "You often thought you might get wounded, you might get killed, but you never thought you'd be taken prisoner." Anyhow, we sat there, and And in come one of our Jeeps with a bullet holes all over the place, driven by a German, got a flat tire. Well, we watched them lift the thing up because